Everyone. I will call this meeting of the Children and Families Committee to order. Ooh, and my mic was already on. Amazing. Can I get a motion from Representative Coulter, because he's looking in this general vicinity? Would you move the minutes from February 25th?
I will make that motion.
Representative Coulter moves to approve the meetings from February 25th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes are adopted. Members of the public, please refrain from standing and just be nice. I'm very tired of reading that script. But the gentleman in the corner with the gold tie will intervene should anything get untoward. No applause or audible response is acceptable in this venue, either for or against. So please sit quietly, and you can testify on any bill you would like. So when we ask for members of the public would like to testify, feel free. You do not need to sign up in advance, assuming we have the time. So, well, actually, I didn't even look. Sorry. I didn't even check if Representative Hudson was here. All right. First on the agenda, we have House File 3542 from Representative Hudson. I will move House File 3542 before the committee. Do you want to take care of the one and talk about your memory? Okay. All right, and we have an author's amendment in the DE1 to address some concerns that have been brought up as this has moved through the process. Representative Hudson, would you like to speak to your amendment? Well, I'll move the DE1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the Children and Families Committee. It's good to be back. This was one of my first committees upon joining this body. So the bill before us today, 3542, the DE changes its structure, integrating feedback that we got both from the agencies and from our Democratic colleagues in the House Fraud Prevention and State Agency Oversight Committee. So first of all, the intention of the underlying bill. The intention of the bill is to provide the public, members of the legislature, members of the press, with access to knowledge of the existence of an investigation that's taking place against entities once the agency has determined that their payment should be reduced, suspended, or withheld. What the DE does is it specifies that in order for that to happen, there first has to be notification of the subject of the investigation. So in other words, the concern here that was expressed by the agencies and by the Democrat members in the Fraud Committee was that we don't want to inadvertently tip somebody off to the fact that an investigation may be taking place if, in fact, they were unaware of that and their that revelation could potentially compromise an investigation. So taking that critique in good faith, the DE is the result of that effort in an attempt to ensure that we both meet the objective of ensuring the public has access to information about the existence of investigations. Again, it's merely the existence. It's not any details about what is being investigated specifically or any of the details of that investigation, but just the fact that it is taking place. And with that, I will take any testimony and submit to questions.
Members, any discussion to the DE1? Representative Hicks.
And I'm sorry, I may have missed this. So I don't understand what existence of an investigation means. So does that mean like in licensing investigations, we post the results of that investigation and it includes a lot of information. What does the existence of an investigation mean?
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hicks. That's a turn of phrase that I came up with on the fly here. Basically, what I'm trying to reference is that the information that members of the legislature and the press are trying to secure is who's being investigated. Can we know who's being investigated? That's the information we're trying to get at. So when I say the existence of the investigation, I'm referring to the fact that an investigation is taking place against a particular entity. That's the information that folks are looking to get access to.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. So, and I'm so sorry, since I come from Human Services, we don't release stuff until after the findings. So like the report will say like what was reported and then what the investigation and the findings. So this would be before any of that. This would be just like we're looking at Sally's daycare because somebody said to look at Sally's daycare. I mean, is that like the threshold or like what, like help me understand like at what point?
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hicks. The trigger would be once the commissioner has determined or the agency has determined to reduce, suspend, or withhold payments and has notified the subject of the investigation that an investigation is taking place at that point, within 30 days of a request from the public, a member of the legislature, a member of the press, they would have to disclose the fact that that investigation is taking place.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, just a quick process question. Is the intent that we would adopt the DE? I mean, it sounds like we're discussing the DE and then we adopt it and we'll move on with our lives. When this is the time to ask questions and have discussion.
We're going to adopt the DE and then discuss the bill. So that we will have a discussion prior to voting on the bill.
Okay. Then I think I, why don't we just go ahead and we can adopt the DE so we're all working from the same thing and then you can come back to me.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. Okay. Well, I already moved the amendment, so all those in favor of the DE1 amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The DE1 amendment is adopted. Now we have another amendment. Chair Cattis Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hudson. With the DE amendment that we just approved, the language of my amendment is sort of null and void. But I just wanted to just speak to a little bit of the direction that we're trying to go. And we brought in some Inspector General language so that it wasn't an issue that was laying with the commissioner. It was something that then the Inspector General would have the ultimate decision to kind of say, yes, this could cause issue in the course of an investigation, or no, it would not. And so I think the idea was that, you know, where the commissioner may not be as close to the details of the investigation, then the Inspector General could come in. So the idea behind the A3 still is important, and that can be a part of the rest of the discussion today. So I will withdraw this, but I know that you did have conversation in the Fraud Prevention Committee with Chair Pinto, and this language kind of came out of that initial discussion. So I appreciate you working on the language going forward and kind of moving through the process, as it were. So I'm happy to have this discussion here today, and I'll withdraw the A3.
Chair Cattis Watoon withdraws the A3 amendment. Are there any members of the public who wishes to speak on this bill? Please continue to the front.
Where do I sit? Next to you?
Okay. Oh. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, I'm Maria Snyder. I am a childcare provider in St. Paul. I run a family business. My mom opened my center in 1998. And I am testifying in opposition to this bill. When Minnesota politicians colluded with a YouTuber to target Somali childcare providers and childcare assistants this year, programs immediately, children, teachers, and families were threatened. I'm going to tell you a couple examples of how my safety was threatened, and I don't have, as far as I know, any pending investigations. One afternoon, a truck of four people circled our building slowly. One person got out and defecated in front of the building. While I was on the phone making that police report, somebody else was circling the building in an SUV, yelling out, "Is this one of those fake daycares? I don't see any kids here." In January and February, ICE activity nearby forced us to go into lockdown multiple times a week. I received a threatening letter for standing up for childcare assistance to my home address. So I would like for you all to imagine how I feel reading a bill like this that essentially would dox childcare providers before an investigation is complete, before there are any official findings. The names of federal agents who've publicly committed abuse on camera are protected. The names of perpetrators in the Epstein files are protected. And yet this bill proposes to expose childcare providers based on unproven childcare assistance allegations. During the month of our most recent CCAP audit, I'm still unclear if a CCAP audit and investigation are the same. I don't know where that threshold lies. We've participated in many audits. That's part of being part of the Child Care Assistance Program. That's fine. They can come. Please ask for our records. We're happy to give them to them. I received an overpayment. The month that they looked at, a family member of mine was in the hospital and I was caring for them. I don't have a billing department, so I was doing billing that month from literally the hospital room. The investigator during that audit found a 5% error rate, so 95% of our records were accurate. I thought that was pretty good. That's like getting an A in school, right? I was fined for errors that were even in childcare assistance's favor, so like where I actually billed for less, but then they charge the max daily rate for any error that you make. So parents sometimes forget to sign in. An absent day might be switched for the wrong Tuesday on a billing form. These are paperwork errors. They're not criminal activities. I did a little Google search, and I found that.
Please wrap up your testimony. We're just kind of keep it 2 minutes, but you can wrap up.
Okay. Sorry, I didn't know. Is there a timer?
I meant to say the timer.
Okay. If it's okay with you, I'll just finish up my last couple sentences here. I did a quick Google search, and I found that auditors at OIG make about $33 to $48 an hour with full benefits, and the average childcare teacher in Minnesota earns less than $20 an hour for no benefits. Our industry is underfunded, understaffed, overregulated, and yet we're using our precious time in this committee to talk about another bill that targets us, exposes us to more harm, and makes us less safe. Please stop criminalizing childcare providers. The vast majority of us are really trying to do our best every day. We're caring for children during the most critical years of their development, and we deserve your support and not your suspicion. Thank you for hearing me out on this.
Thank you for testifying today. I'm very sorry that you had to endure that. Oh, my God. I neglected to say, so I apologize. Two minute testimony, please, for future testifiers. Next on the list is Mary Solheim.
Good afternoon. My name is Mary Solheim, and I'm a provider in Maplewood. But I classify myself as a child care warrior because I've lived through some months that have been horrendous. And it is because of the exposure to our center and to myself, and I would like to share some of those with you today. I think that my child care status as warrior has been well earned. I am just one of many that have survived these last few months. One of the messages that I got from the Nick Shirley video was this, and I'm going to keep the words to a nice, acceptable level here. This message is for Mary. Mary, if I was in front of your face, I'd smile, I'd laugh, and call you an effing liar to your face. You're in way over your head, sweetheart. All of you, you are all going down. Another one told me that I'm lying and stealing taxpayer money and that there is no way the parents of the 23,000 kids on the child care assistance are working. It ends with, so I'm recommending you to the authorities to be investigated. We will not rest until you are removed, preferably in handcuffs. Then they found my family. Deeply disturbing threats, classifying my siblings, parents, grandparents as a Somali-loving A-word who should be beaten with the same bat that beat a Somali M-effer to death. I'm just a child care provider. I love what I do. I do my best every single day with kids from multiple backgrounds with multiple health issues. There are many that are on child care assistance. Child care providers like myself spend an excruciating number of hours to comply with these requirements within that child care assistance program. And this bill ensures that so many more of our child care centers may be exposed and be exposed to these kinds of messages. We are not out here committing fraud. We don't have time, really, to do that. I don't know what that would look like. Honestly, I'm asking you today is to please come together to make our children's safety and care your first priority. Bills like this only punish all collectively for the actions of a few. You have the opportunity to write a new story here into history. Create a care system that supports all without punishing children, workers, and families. Minnesota should be the example that others strive to match. Child care has endured enough punishment. We want better for all. I can guarantee that all of these warriors here today will not rest until our children and workers have what they deserve. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Yes.
Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your
okay.
testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Monique Stuman. I am a director in North Minneapolis. I am here today to talk about my concerns with this bill. I have a number of parents that I did a survey this morning to get their feedback. And out of 50-some parents, only two of them said yes, they wanted it. So I wanted to share that. I think being in this industry for 30-plus years in education and 20 years in early childhood, I've never felt the heaviness that I feel right now and the sadness that people have brought on the state of Minnesota to our youngest Minnesotans. This is not fair. When you look at fraud, you think of, well, I think of intentional fraud. Not accountant errors. It saddens me that I have to come here today and leave the center where my children need me right now. But I have to come in here and beg and ask you all to please simply do the right thing. We are not criminals. You should not treat us as such. If your peers that are sitting next to you did something wrong, you would not want to be scrutinized for what they did. And that's what it feels like. I am saddened that we would allow a YouTuber to come to Minnesota and do what he did. We don't approve fraud. Fraud is not right, and those people that are doing that need to be held accountable for it. But for you all to do that to us, somebody like me that has dedicated my life to this, I am sad and I am hurt. And the kids that I serve, the little black and brown kids mostly, they're the ones that are getting hurt the most by this. I can't ask you enough. And Senator West, I remember at a roundtable meeting with you, I felt your passion about what the incident that happened. And when you said what you said next to me, it shook me to my core. And for you to come up to me afterwards and apologize for how you responded and reacted in that roundtable meeting, it meant a lot to me. So much so that I sent you, Senator Bobby Joe, and Senator Hoffman an email. And I only got one response from Senator John Hoffman. You guys can't keep criminalizing us. We are the bridge for these babies to go to school. We're not criminals. We dedicate our lives to this. Hold the people accountable that are doing it. And I often figure out how. I get a letter from the state, 3 months, they can come in at any given time. And you tell me this wasn't found? The city inspector comes in 12 months out of the year, anytime they want. They didn't see it. The food people, the food inspectors, they didn't see that there were no children. Like, I just don't understand how. How could something like this go so long? And then you want to make us the criminals. We're not writing the checks. We don't have any power. I had a parent that didn't even turn in her schedule for work, and they turned her CCAP off like that. So how are we criminalized? I'm 55 years old, and I'm tired, and I'm trying to give my babies everything that I have. I'm not perfect. I will make errors. But for you to call me a criminal, for you to call it fraud, I'm asking you all today, do the right thing. I'm pleading with this side over here. Do the right thing. Do the right thing. Black and brown children suffer enough in this state. They do. I see it every day.
Please wrap up your testimony. It's almost
so I'm asking you all to simply do the right thing. That's all. We're not criminals, and you wouldn't want to be persecuted for something that you didn't do, that your peers did. Neither do we. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Please, no external approval or disapproval from the audience. Ifra Noor should be joining us on Zoom. Please unmute yourself and testify. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. Turn back here. Good afternoon. My name is Ifra Noor, and I am a child care provider in Bloomington. I am testifying against HF3542. In the past few months have been devastating. The Nick Shirley video, the threat of losing federal child care funding, and the ICE activities have been completely changed our lives. At my child care center, we are licensed to have 57 children for each of our three shifts, so we can have about 171 kids enrolled. Before January, we had 95 children enrolled, and now we have 75 children enrolled. And many children are still not coming because of the families that are afraid to leave home. This is what happens when people decide to spread false narratives without evidence. Real people, real families, and real children get hurt. Our kids no longer play imaginatively about what they will be when they grow up. Now they play how they will hide when ICE agents show up at our centers. Our kids no longer play happily if their parents are running a little late. They are in panic. The harassment Somali child care centers and the other child care providers have received in the past few months shows just how dangerous HF3542 is. In this country, people are innocent until proven guilty. This bill guarantees...
Ifra, your Zoom just got muted, it looks like?
No.
Or no?
She's had some connection issues.
No, it's. I don't know if you can hear us, but we cannot hear you. Let's see if we can fix this. One moment. Oh, we're starting to hear you come in and out.
Oh, I'm sorry.
There we go. So about 15 seconds ago, you broke up, but we hear you now.
Sorry. So there's 14 centers that recently had their CCAP cut off this year because the attendance records show the same person signed in many of their school-age kids as they arrived to the centers. These kids are mostly dropped off by school buses or are dropped off by child care center staff. Their parents cannot leave to work to sign them in. This bill will only lead to more unfair treatment and closing of childcare programs that are doing everything they can to meet the needs of these families in this state. I urge you to vote no on this bill and instead focus on legislative that seeks to address issues in partnership with providers rather than create chaos for those programs that serve low-income families who are disproportionately people of color. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public? That completes our list. Are there any other members of the public who would like to testify on this bill? Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. I'm Claire Sanford, and I am on the board of the Minnesota Child Care Association. And I just want to add to the things you've heard from other providers who are much closer to the operations than I am, and just add that over the last 2 months, providers have received, I have spoken with so many death threats, threats via social media, threats on their voicemail, threats emailed to them, threats sent to their homes, people showing up at their programs and doing threatening and sometimes disgusting things, as you heard about. And it has had a real chilling effect on providers willing to speak about it. I have talked to many providers over the last few months who I go to with an opportunity to speak to the media, and these are providers who willingly do that all the time, and they say, I can't anymore. I'm too afraid of the exposure that me being in the press would bring upon my program. Sometimes they tell me my parents are revolting that I spoke to the press or that I testified at the legislature because they feel like by doing that, I'm putting a target on their children's back and our program's back. So I just want people to be aware that there are so many more who are experiencing things and have been frightened into not testifying here or speaking to the media. And those of us here today are speaking on behalf of them as well. So I, as MCCA, am in opposition to this bill because I think it moves us further from innocent until proven guilty. And we've seen all of these threats in situations where there has been no actual investigation. People just had ideas in their heads and went to go threaten people. So it seems that it would be even more dangerous to disclose investigations that may not result in any criminal activity. They're still investigations. And give people even more juice to threaten and harass people. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sanford. Any other members of the public who would like to testify? And I hope these individuals making threats at you are reported to the police so that they can be charged. Representative Hudson, would you like to say anything before we go to member questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would. Let me start by grounding us in what it is that we're actually talking about. Much of what was just testified to had nothing whatsoever to do with this bill at all. We are not talking about targeting child cares as a category. We're not talking about targeting anyone. We're talking about providing information to the public about confirmed ongoing investigations that the subject of those investigations has been made aware of, and where circumstances have justified in the eyes of the agency either the reduction, suspension, or withholding of payments. So this is not a situation, we're not engaging in convictions here. We're not throwing people in jail with this bill. We are not endorsing or supporting threats or other criminal behavior directed against any child care. And what I would suggest is that to the extent that that's a problem, and I have no doubt that it is, the appropriate response is for law enforcement and prosecutors to do their job and ensure that such people have the book thrown at them to the fullest extent of the law. What we should not do in this body is allow ourselves to be distracted by our obligation to take the action necessary to ensure that the public is informed about what its government is doing, where their taxpayer dollars are going, and the existence of investigations where there's been generated enough cause for a commissioner to decide to suspend, reduce, or withhold payments. We should not allow our judgment on that question to be influenced by deficiencies in other areas of jurisdiction. Again, this bill, as amended, would simply make it so that when the public puts in a specific request, whether it's a member of the press or a member of this legislature, which isn't nice when we make these decisions when we actually know what's going on as a result of the laws that we write, when we have transparency with our executive, transparency with the agencies, I find that helpful, kind of like turning on the headlights in your car at night, right? That should be the focus of the consideration here today in this committee. To the extent that there are other issues adjacent to it, sounds like a lot of them should be dealt with in public safety. A lot of them should be dealt with in judiciary. Here we're talking about the conduct of children and families.
Chair Katisa Watum.
Thank you, Chair West. And Representative Hudson, you handled that testimony with the exact amount of emotional quotient that I would have expected you to. I am absolutely disgusted by your response to the providers who have told
Mr. Chair,
you,
personalities.
Excuse me.
Mr. Chair, personalities.
We have committee rules.
Your committee rule says you can say you're disgusted with my person?
She can, like,
are you out of your mind?
Representative Hudson, she's speaking of her personal opinion. She feels disgusted. I don't like.
The comment was directed specifically at my person, Mr. Chair. That's outside of the realm of these rules and outside of our custom and usage in this body, and I'm not going to stand for it because you want to put on a little performance.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would have to agree with Representative Hudson. It is against our rules to be impugning someone's personality by saying they're disgusted by what he said at a fellow legislator when he's responding. I think that was inappropriate, and I back Representative Hudson up. You can say you were saddened by it, but
Chair,
to say you're disgusted.
I have a question, Chair.
You need to of what Representative Hudson said in response to that is out of order and against our rules of the House.
Let's just recalibrate here and start with Khatiza Batoum, Chair Khatiza Batoum. Chair Khatiza Batoum.
It is unfortunate the way that you chose to respond to the providers who took time out of their busy schedules caring for Minnesota's children to come here and share their experience with you. And for you to respond in the way you did was uncharacteristic of someone who has election certificate, in my opinion. This is not a horse and pony show. These are real people and real lives. And this bill is going to have an impact on the work that they do and the children that they serve. And yes, you are sitting before the Children and Families Committee, and we will discuss issues that are going to impact the children and families of Minnesota. Mr. Chair, I believe that the Inspector General is with us today. Can he come up to the testifier's table? I've got a line of questioning.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
I think since the co-chair addressed our state representative, our bill author, I think he has a right to respond to her comment before anyone else is brought up to the testifying table. I think that's fair and a custom and practice in the 16 years I've been here in this legislature. You just mentioned to the author you were disgusted, saddened, and I think at this point, because of our customs and usage, the author should have an opportunity to respond before anyone else is brought up to the testifying table.
Mr. Chair, I would like to make an alternative option that the chair is entitled to her opinion and to ask the questions. The chair runs this committee, and you have done so with respect, by and large, and I really encourage you to maintain that. Thank you.
I think we should continue with Chair Khatiza Batoum, since it was her line of questioning. Representative Hudson, when she's complete, we will go to you. We should all disagree, but you don't have to get under the skin. The things we've all been called as elected officials, it happens. Emotions run high, but we're here for the thing at hand. And if half of what we do is a dog and pony show, it really is, if we're being honest, on both sides. So, how I like to run this committee is to keep it towards the actual content of the bill. Sometimes members go beyond that, and I wish they wouldn't, but everybody here has an election certificate. Everyone here will have a chance to respond to another member, and I would just encourage everybody to realize that people can say, you know, as long as they don't impugn motive, sure, we can do that, but people can feel how they're going to feel, and, you know, it's just something that we all have to live with as human beings, and in particular as legislators, because plenty of people hate us who don't even know the first thing about us. But I would encourage members to treat each other with more kindness and respect and not assume people are acting out of malice and disregard. With that said, we'll bring the OIG up for Chair Khatiza Batoum's question.
Inspector General Keyes, thank you for joining us again today. I'm just hoping that you can give us a little bit of clarity on, again, the investigatory process. So when one of the providers was up speaking to admin or clerical error that may be flagged throughout the process to ensure that, you know, again, a simple mistype or maybe something was flagged under a child's name or a day that the child wasn't there and it was just a simple mistake versus intentional fraud. How are you or one of your investigators able to maybe subdivide those type of issues that come before you and to make a determination on whether or not a provider may be intentionally defrauding the program or if they've made a simple clerical error?
Mr. Keyes.
Chair, members. So part of it, we look at the evidence we gather. We look at do we have records or not? Are the records accurate? How inaccurate are they, right? I mean, there's a, we completed one review last week and there were zero errors. So we know that people can meet that standard. We've seen some with 5 or 10% errors, right? And that generally results in an overpayment. To get to the level of disqualifying someone from CCAP, so after the investigation is over, we're looking at something that's beyond sort of a mistake, right? When you start to see the same thing repeated over and over again, or we've seen, we've done training with the person through the early and often program, and they're doing the same thing wrong over and over again. So we're looking for that kind of information, but we don't have to get to intentional fraud. That's a criminal standard. We're doing administrative investigations. And so it's something less than that, but it's enough of a financial misconduct is how the statute describes the investigations we do. It's enough of a problem where they shouldn't be allowed to continue to receive public funds.
Chair Katizabatun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for that. That's really helpful. I know at a certain point in time, you know, you pull in partners from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and they kind of take on any ongoing criminal investigations. What I'm curious of in the language of Representative Hudson's DE, they're in line, no, that's not the DE, sorry. There's the DE. In line 2.13, it says it must be disclosed within 30 days of a request if the commissioner has reduced, suspended, or withheld payments and notified the subject of the investigation. First, I want to express my gratitude to Representative Hudson for including the notification of the subject because I feel that would have potentially impeded your investigation going forward. But can you give us a little bit more information on the timeline that yourself or your staff is working on when they are doing some of that administrative investigation? So if if the commissioner has chosen to reduce, suspend, or withhold payments, that there's probably a runway up to that. It's not like we get the attendance notification where, again, maybe a name is wrong here or something, you know, something little like that. I just want to make sure that it's this, the request would not be too soon for you to determine whether or not somebody just made a typo on their report. And so then their information is being released to the public. And then 5 days after that, you give them the rubber stamp of approval and they're cleared from that investigation. Does that make sense?
Mr. Keyes.
Chair, members. Looking at this bill, a couple things. This doesn't help me in any way. So let's be clear, this is not going to help my work. We saw during the period of time where the videos were released that you've heard people talk about and centers were identified in the video, there were vigilante self-help investigators that showed up, actually interfered with some of our ongoing investigations. And so that's one of our concerns is as this information becomes public, there's a potential for people to self-help, and that interferes with our work. The action to limit, to take action to stop payment during the investigation, it's a statutory authority. It's based on a credible allegation of fraud. That is a lower standard than what it takes to disqualify someone after we've done our investigation. We sometimes make that decision very early based on the initial records that we collect, where we think there's enough there to stop payment. We're concerned enough to stop payment while we do our investigation, but we still have to do the investigation and determine whether or not there is sufficient evidence to disqualify them. If we don't disqualify them, we have to turn the payments back on. So there are, I think our concern is, one, that people will go out and interfere with sort of the work that we're doing, whether they're doing it intentionally or not, just as you heard about people driving around and causing trouble. And then because it's a lower threshold, we're really labeling people publicly as being subject to an investigation. People can make assumptions about what that is from that point. And it's not fair to the providers in some ways. They know, but I don't know that we need to brand them publicly before we've completed the investigation and determined what's happened. And just to sort of round out, I also got threatening letters at the same time. So they didn't just target the providers. They also targeted state staff who were investigating the providers.
Chair Katiz Witun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's really helpful. I guess one thing that we may want to consider as this bill moves forward, Representative Hudson, is some sort of like buffer time frame. I'm not sure exactly how that would work, but in partnership with the Inspector General, we could maybe work something out so that, I mean, I think that, I know we talk a lot about unintended consequences in this body, and I think, you know, if we were able to work together, set emotions aside, work together and make some small changes in this language to prevent some of the providers from being attacked or, you know, provoked or harassed in the ways that they told us they have been, I think that we would all want to do that. So it would be my hope that, you know, we could potentially find some change in the language going forward that could prevent people's information from being released if the investigation is then going to just say wrongdoing has not been found here, basically. So, Inspector General, I appreciate your thoughts on that.
Apparently, my daughter has a fever and needs to be picked up from daycare right now. How on topic. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Chair West and Chair Katiz Witun. I most certainly appreciate the focus on policy. That's what we're here to do, and I'm glad we've returned to policy. I have no problem working with the Inspector General or any of the agencies on trying to come up with a language that actually affects the goal that we're trying to achieve here, which is public transparency regarding the relationships between these entities and the state that is funded by their tax dollars. The concerns about people being targeted and people being harassed, again, I hold to be a parallel concern that needs to be addressed through strong, robust law enforcement and prosecution of those sorts of actions. I am resistant to the idea that our policy here in terms of how transparent we are with our voters and our taxpayers should be unduly influenced by the failure of those systems to provide that law enforcement and that prosecution. And if there's legislation we need to change in that regard, again, we have jurisdictions of committee or committees of jurisdiction to take care of that. But by all means, if there is a solution to this problem that makes more sense than the current DE, happy to address it.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a few, just a few thoughts, and I do have one question for the author. But, you know, as I was sitting here listening to Mr. Keyes, I was sort of reminded why we don't handle criminal investigations this way. We don't publicly release names of people who are under investigation in advance. Now, part of that is, you know, the reason that we have spoken to that it may compromise the investigation, but part of it is to avoid the potential blowback, the potential issues that we have heard from folks, and that Chair Katiz Witun and I heard last night from providers. And I think one of the things that we as lawmakers have to consider as we are making laws is not just sort of what's on the written page, but how this plays out in the real world and the practical effect of doing this to the providers and the families who depend on them and the people who depend on families who depend on childcare, which it turns out is every single one of us. And I think, so when you say that's a parallel concern, I don't agree with that. I just don't. And I mean, I think when we balance that against sort of what this does for the investigatory process, you know, I wrote down something that Mr. Keyes just said right now. He said, this doesn't help me. This doesn't help me do my job. That's what he was saying there. And so sort of on both sides of this, the practical effect of what this might mean for providers and families, in addition to the fact that our own inspector general is saying this will not help him do this, his job, it seems to me that is pretty ample evidence not to support this. But the question I have for you, Representative Hudson, I do also, I meant to do this at the beginning, I want to acknowledge that I think you did make a good faith effort to address some of the concerns that folks raised, and I do appreciate that. But if I look at sort of what I would consider the meat of the bill in the DE, it's lines 2.13 through 2.15. It's sort of an either or piece here, right? So it says, notwithstanding this, the existence of an investigation, and then it's basically either paragraph one or paragraph two, either must be disclosed within 30 days of a request, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, or may be disclosed at any time, as long as it doesn't compromise the investigation. So the way I read this language, while I recognize that you made an effort to address the concern, it seems to me that the way I read that language on lines 2.13 and 2.14, that, I mean, this requirement would come into effect regardless of whether or not it would compromise an investigation. And so, I mean, I am all for transparency, but if the purpose is conducting an investigation and this information would become public regardless, how does that serve the public interest?
Thank you, Representative Coulter. There are situations that happen where they do confirm investigations, criminal or civil. It does happen. It's not something that's never done. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Chair Wesson. Thank you, Representative Coulter. So I'll get to the answer to your specific question, but before I do, I want to address what you had said prior about the testimony from the AG suggesting that this provision would not make his job easier. Our job is oversight. Our job is to write laws that serve our constituents. Our job is not to make the state agency's job easy. I think there are many who would agree with the general assessment that this body has made the state agency's job way too easy, way too loosey-goosey, which is part of the motivation for bringing a provision like this to the table. This is an intent to remove discretion, to your point. Absolutely. The language that you cited, the either or, the information shall be disclosed within 30 days. The or is, unless the inspector general, I believe the language is, determines that doing so earlier would not compromise an investigation. So the notion there is that they have that discretion. They can certainly decide that disclosing to the public upon request, we're not talking about a general announcement, we're not going to take out a billboard, but disclosing to a particular requester of the information, the fact that this investigation is taking place, should happen under these circumstances within 30 days. Now, one of the arguments we heard in the House Fraud Prevention Committee was that we're concerned about the destruction of evidence in an investigation, right? That somebody's gonna delete their emails, destroy their computers, shred their files, whatever the case may be. Well, under the current language of this DE, the subject of the investigation has to have been notified that they are in fact under investigation. So if they were going to do that, they would have already had 30 days to do it. The idea that because a reporter or one of our members
gets hold of the fact that that investigation is taking place and that that's going to be the trigger for them to destroy evidence, I find less than convincing.
Representative Colton.
I will just note to that point, it does specify that the information must be disclosed. It does not specify to whom that information must be disclosed. So I think, to your point, if that is the intent of the bill, it might be worthy of limiting that a bit. Thank you.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Chair West. Sure. I think it's implicit that upon request means the information be disclosed to the person requesting it. But if we want to specify that further in language, happy to do so.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, some of my questions were kind of answered in the last 10 or 15 minutes in that the high emotion range. I do want to acknowledge, I think the Chair West, I appreciated what you said, kind of brought it down to bringing our emotions down. And that is important. I was going to defend and or at least speak on behalf of Representative Hudson when he did at first say that those who did those disgusting things that the testifiers testified to, swearing, following, threatening, defecating, those are so disgusting that we must call out. And Representative Hudson did say those people that do such disgusting things that our testifiers testified, and IG King Keyes mentioned that his death threats as well, they need to be prosecuted the full extent of the law, and I appreciated Representative Hudson said that twice. Just because he wasn't crying doesn't mean he wasn't emotional about it. Representative Coulter, do you remember a couple years ago when Labor and Industry, the Democrats passed a bill and put into law that any violations in the workforce by businesses must be posted right away. Do you remember that? Yeah. Any violations, not even a 30-day, posted through the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. Private businesses, without investigations. This is investigated with 30 days. You voted for and passed bills that would, any violations within the business community, manufacturing or whatever, be posted immediately with no investigations. Do you see the hypocrisy in that, Representative Coulter? And now you're arguing the fact with Representative Hudson's bill doing the very thing, same thing that you voted for, except he's giving 30 days notice with investigation before they post the notification. Think about that when you vote for this bill. I don't think I have anything else to say. I had some questions. One of the testifiers said that Minnesota politicians were colluding with the YouTube. I'm a Minnesota politician. I don't know who she was speaking about, that we as Minnesota politicians were colluding with a YouTuber. I kind of wanted her to explain that, but maybe it's a moot point at this juncture. Representative Hudson, your bill, although you mentioned earlier, is not perfect, and you're willing to work with the IG, and you worked with the Democrats in the Fraud Committee, and that's what we do here. We collude to make laws better and to try to get to the heart of the fraud, and that everyone should be disgusted with. And I hope the testifiers who are here are taking care of our children, and we love you for that, are just as disgusted with the billions or millions that have been defrauded us. And you should, no, my mom always said, never should on someone. You could be thankful or willing to work with Representative Hudson and the Democrats and the Republicans to make sure that our laws prohibit any further eroding and frauding of our millions and billions of dollars. Under our nose. I've been here 16 years. Under our noses, they did this. So, Representative Hudson, your bill does not punish children, families, or workers, does it?
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative McDonald. Despite the peanut gallery, no, it absolutely does not. Objectively, it simply reveals public information upon request when an investigation is taking place. In order for this to hurt somebody, they would have had to engage in conduct that warranted the commissioner reducing, suspending, or withholding their payments. And the only harm that could legally come to them would be the reputational harm of having that investigation disclosed. That is not sufficient reason to evade transparency from the very people who are paying the tax dollars that make these programs possible.
Representative McDonald.
Lastly, just a thought, maybe this isn't the case, but maybe staff can help. Last year, our focus in this committee was the abuse of children, including our chair, West, by some bad actors. And we know that there's a lot of good daycare providers that love our children and take very good care of them. But we did focus and had very emotional testifying. XP, you weren't here, Representative Lee, but many of us were crying because we wanted to get to the heart and stop and prohibit any employee or daycare provider from hurting innocent children, not even their own. So in Representative Hudson's bill, if it should become law, would it also pertain to a provider that has maybe injured, or an employee, not a provider, but an employee injured wrongfully our children who are in a daycare provider? Would this bill help the public and us legislators know about that ahead of time?
Ms. Sunderman.
Mr. Chair and members, no, this bill is limited to investigations of possible overpayments of public funds or the reduction or withholding of payments in this bill.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. Well, that's something to work on, Representative Hudson. Maybe we can have an amendment to add to it any harm or violation to our children in addition to fraud. Matter of fact, that's worse than fraud, isn't it? The harming of our children. But we dealt with that last year. We're trying to deal with fraud this year, and we'll continue to work on it. I appreciate your work, Representative Hudson. I'm glad that we are acknowledging some deficiencies in the bill and fixing it, like with your D1 amendment, and working with IG Keys to make the bill better. That's all I have to say for now, Mr. Chair.
We do have another bill to get to and quite a few people on the list, so please keep your remarks somewhat brief. Representative Sensormura.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hudson, for bringing this bill. Did your caucus, the House GOP, provide Nick Shirley with the list of child care centers?
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Sensormura. Granting you the courtesy of acknowledging that that question has nothing whatsoever to do with the bill before us, the answer is, to my knowledge, absolutely not.
Representative Sensormura.
Thank you. I just, you know, I thought I would ask the question that I think Representative McDonald was getting at, that I think is underlying this whole conversation. And I don't know, right? I have no idea if they did or not. I thought I heard at one point that someone from your caucus was saying that they had provided that information, that there was some connection between someone, a staff member in your caucus, and Nick Shirley. I don't know the truth of that, but I do know what came after that, right, which was stories that we heard about today, people in my community being terrorized, parents telling me that BCA was coming into their child care centers with guns, asking, you know, why are people with guns coming into our child care centers? A reign of terror and retribution from literally, I mean, reign of retribution, I think was the words that our president used. Feeling like a war was started on my community from a right-wing YouTuber 23-year-old video that had some connection to the House GOP. So that is the context in which I'm hearing this bill. I'm trying to accept a good faith argument that we do care about fraud. Fraud is disgusting. Taking money from kids and families is disgusting. Maltreatment is disgusting. Those, to me, as I understand it, with our current system, are two separate systems for looking at that and two separate things. I think one of the things that I have been confused about looking into some of the centers that were detailed in Nick Shirley's fake investigations, right? But then I actually looked, right, and I saw that many of them had many different violations, right? And so if I look at that, I say, that sounds really concerning. Like, if I'm a parent and I'm going to the, you know, page and I see that this center has 10 violations, that sounds really concerning to me. I think we could have a conversation about whether that is a program where we want to invest CCAP dollars in. But actually, to me, when I read the violations, I thought, this doesn't seem like fraud. Because to have this kind of violation, it meant that someone went in, there was a bunch of kids there, they saw that something was happening that probably wasn't great for kids, and they documented it, and that's a violation, potentially, right? But to me, that is different than fraud. And so I am still confused about what the point of this is. Are we trying to make sure that our public dollars are going to high quality programs? Are we trying to let right-wing YouTubers get the information of childcare centers so that they can then send vigilantes to come and terrorize our kids? Help me understand what is the benefit of this bill?
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Chair West. Thank you, Representative Sensenbrenner, for that question. And frankly, for the opportunity to address, I guess we're talking about Nick Shirley today. I don't know how that became part of the subject matter, but here we go. So based upon my personal knowledge, public comments that have been made by Speaker Damith and others, including David Hawk, who was the other gentleman in the video that we're talking about here, the Nick Shirley video, the best I can surmise, and this is my opinion, is that David Hawk had been working for months requesting information from people who he knows who work at the Capitol. Whether or not one or more of those people, or however many of them there were, worked for the House Republican Caucus, I think is immaterial because we have this thing called constituent services. Any one of us who gets a phone call with a request from the public for information that is of public note and public use and available to the public is generally going to have that request fulfilled. That's an appropriate role that we engage in with our constituents. It's my understanding that David Hawk took that material, gathered over much time, conducted what he describes as his own personal investigation. I have no opinion of or have made any study of the integrity of that investigation, the methodologies that he used. One thing I can tell you is that the day that Nick Shirley came to town, it was during the interim, I believe it was December, we were having a meeting of the House Fraud Prevention Committee, and Nick Shirley was there. And none of us knew who he was. He came up to me afterwards, interviewed me. We had a really nice little conversation. Never put it out, that's fine. Then he turned and had his conversation with Representative Greenman, which he very much did put out, and we all saw that. And none of us knew who he was. I sat there and I asked him, what's your deal? Oh, I got a YouTube channel. Oh, I got an X-Kid. Oh, okay, I'll look you up, see, you know. And like a week later, this all blew up. So the idea that there was some sort of coordinated conspiracy amongst House Republicans to bring Nick Shirley into town and to sick him on businesses, I can assure you, that type of move, and I'm looking at my members now, can you imagine the conversation in caucus if somebody were to raise that proposal? You know what we should do? We should bring a 23-year-old into town and just sick him on businesses and see what happens. How do you think that conversation would go? If we had half that boldness, right, the things that we could do. So that there was no connection there. Other than what you could expect from typical constituent services. As to your question about the intent of the bill and the motivation behind the bill, is the desire to fuel 15 more Nick Shirleys coming to town doing the same thing? Absolutely not. In fact, I would very much caution and argue against anybody engaging in the methodology that Shirley used for a variety of reasons, not the least of which are the externalities that were described here in testimony today. Be that as it may, we can't just decide that because that happened, we're just going to shut down all transparency, or we're not going to do anything in the midst of what has been, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office, potentially billions, $9 billion worth of fraud, that we're just going to say the status quo of transparency is fine. We need do nothing because a YouTuber came to town.
Yeah, it is my dream we can get back to the substance of the bill and keep comments like this relatively short. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Representative Hudson, there is a aggressive, I would even say a rabid, audience out there, as evidenced by everyone's testimony, even our OIG. So, Chair, if I could, I know we're fast on time, but I wanted to bring up one of the testifiers, and I forget your name. I'm sorry, the one who talked about this being a possible doxing of yeah, please come and remind your name. If you could come back up to the, I'd like to ask you a question about that.
Go ahead and ask your question while she comes up.
In this conversation, you know, now we're towards the end of it, Representative Hudson, the author, says that this is not meant to support any political theater or the like. And you were in particular, what you said stuck out to me in terms of this, comparing this to a, you know, a doxing event. So what? How do you feel about what has been said, and why do you call it a doxing?
Please reintroduce yourself for
sure.
The record.
Sure. I'm Maria Snyder. I feel disrespected. I feel insulted. I feel like you would put children and childcare providers like me at risk so that you could get a headline. You could get political points. I hate feeling like that. I really want to believe that everybody's here in this committee because we care about children and we want the policies to work well for children, families, and providers. But it's hard for me to believe that when I read a bill that says before any findings that my name could be published on the commissioner's website.
Thank you. So that's... Thank you, Chair. That's my point. I think I would go the other way keep the original language and actually change it instead of must to shall not, and just keep everything, not allow for any information to be shared until there is the end of the investigation. And so I will not be supporting this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Hance.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Hudson, I just want to ask, just to put on the record, why not? Can you tell me a little bit about how you approach stakeholders to really get on the same page with them about your proposal and understanding the ways that it impacted them, stakeholders including the department, the OIG, some of the folks who spoke here today? Can you just help me understand how you got to that process or if you at all worked with them?
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Chair West, and thank you, Representative Hansen. This process has taken place entirely out in the open in committees like this. This committee and the House Fraud Committee, those discussions took place, again, with agency representatives and with members of your own caucus addressing their concerns. I have to say, I never could have anticipated the level of pushback to such a simple act of transparency. Again, the characterization of this as putting somebody's name on a website, that's not what this bill does. This bill would enable, would require the agency to respond to a specific request for a specific piece of information under very, very specific circumstances. And so the idea that something that simple requires some sort of summit between a dozen stakeholders, I think is a bit of an overreach. This is a pretty simple effort in government transparency.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I was just curious. I have a master's degree in advocacy and political leadership, and I teach in a program like that. So this will be something we probably talk about in class this fall because stakeholder engagement is critical. There's so many unintended consequences from what we do here at the Capitol that it's important that we have a broad sight of where our bills could, you know, the ripple effect, where they could hit. And I think the people who would end up in the disclosure of such a list like this were probably important people to include. So hopefully that can be a lesson for all of us. My next question is, do you have any comments or recommendations for the women who shared their stories today about the men who terrified them and what we can do in a world like we live in today where men can just get away with this? And you mentioned law enforcement. I heard you say that. I would be willing to bet a number of them contacted law enforcement. I know folks in my community, for example, one of my child care centers contacted me, and I brought this up at another committee here. and said that there were strange men looking in the windows of their childcare center for weeks after Nick Shirley left. And so I think, like, that's the connection. And I hear you saying that you don't see the connection, but I think you do see the connection, that there's a line there. And I hope we can kind of draw that out. Folks did not come here and take time away from the children that the families trust them to take care of to just pull your leg, right? It is, these are real stories from real women. And I come from a world, I was raised by a Republican, and I was taught that, you know, there's honor in listening to the stories of women who are attacked by men. And there's honor in standing with those women. And there's integrity in honoring that space and having some compassion for that. I wanted to highlight that and give you a chance to say, do you have anything to share or recommendations for women who are experiencing violence against them, like what we experienced and what we heard about today?
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm trying to go back to how you started, how you led up to your question. You said, yes, that's right. You were talking, you questioned me about engaging with stakeholders. And apparently amongst the list of stakeholders who you're concerned about is folks who are currently under investigation, know about it, and have had findings brought against them to justify the suspension, withholding, or reduction of their payments. No, I didn't talk to those folks. I wasn't interested in their opinion. I'm not interested in the opinions of people who are under investigation and who the agency has determined that we can't be paying them anymore because they're too high of a risk. They were not part of this conversation, and they shouldn't be. As to the second part of your conversation or your question regarding what I would say, to anyone who finds themselves under the type of vicious attacks that we heard described here today, is that clearly we are failing you. Clearly. If that's something that was allowed to happen on an ongoing basis and nothing was done about it, and the people responsible are still out there walking around thinking they can get away with doing it again, that is a failure of our system. Now, you want to bring a bill or consider a bill that I or anyone else drafts that provides severe life-altering consequences for somebody who would terrorize a daycare and its employees, I'm all over it. You'll have that vote in a clean second. That is, because again, compassion and empathy and emotional acuity notwithstanding, our job here is to author and consider policy. And that policy is going to be a separate matter than this policy.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Hudson. I just wanted you to just be direct about it. I know that's the kind of guy you are, so I wanted to just hear that from your mouth and give you a chance to mention that. Chair West, I would like to request a roll call on this, too, before I forget.
A roll call being requested. There will be a roll call. Representative Hanson.
And thank you, Chair. I agree with you that we should hold men accountable who terrorize daycares like this. It would be actually something I think a number of folks who would come forward to testify about. The violence that women face in this world, this is something I talk about. I'm an indoctrinated feminist. I really believe that when women do better, everybody does better, including children and men and people of color and people with disabilities. We can really all do better. And the data tells us that too. So I really stand strongly in making sure we're addressing these issues head on. And so I want to hear you all to hear me say too that I hear you, and we do know it's when we see violence like this happening against people who are providing care for our littlest Minnesotans, that is, I think, a canary in the coal mine, and we should be really concerned about what our society is doing if we're normalizing this kind of behavior, which is why it's so concerning that Speaker Damuth said on December 29th, in the first 30 seconds of that press conference, that the caucus had been working with Nick Shirley. And so I think, like, that's something we need to discuss and just get on the same page about, because I do think transparency, which has been the theme here, is really important. And so I don't think we can, you know, kind of hide behind the curtain and play Oz here. So whether it's inadvertent or unintended consequences, we do still have a responsibility to be honest with people. And I love that we're talking about public transparency and all of the things folks will address. I think we had a very spirited debate on the House floor the other day about public transparency. And I would love for that to be the thread of everything that happens in state and federal government going forward, that there's transparency in communication between state and federal government, that there's transparency in the funding mechanisms between state and federal government, that there is transparency in what we say in committee and what we tell testifiers that come here. I think we owe that to folks. So I appreciate you answering the questions that I had. I think that was everything that I was looking for. If we can just get a roll call vote on this, I would appreciate it. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Hicks and then Representative Hudson, then we will go to a vote.
Thank you so much, Chair. I have a different question than what I started with because a bunch of it got answered. But after listening to all of the discussion, why not just wait until after conviction?
Representative Hicks, do you have any more questions? Because I want to be quickly.
Yeah, no, that's my question. Why not just wait until after conviction to allow the information to be public?
Representative Hudson, then we will go to
the vote. Is that a weird question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hicks. That is an outstanding question. Part of what we're trying to get to the bottom of here is, are these investigations being taken seriously by the agencies? The lack of transparency and the outcomes that we've seen in terms of press reports, press investigations, prosecutions brought by the U.S. Attorney's Office all suggest that there is a massive disconnect between the number of fraudulent activities that are taking place and the capacity of people to be held accountable for it. We have heard in the fraud committee and we heard from the U.S. Attorney themselves that we're not going to be able to prosecute our way out of this problem, which is another way of saying injustice shall stand. People are going to get away with it. We heard that we don't have the capacity, the prosecutorial and oversight capacity. That's something we've heard in fraud committee on multiple occasions. We just don't have enough people to go after all of these cases. So what that tells us is that there's a lot more going on than we currently are aware of. The public has a right to know that. And so if we're waiting for the very agencies that are telling us they don't have the resources to get to a conviction to get to a conviction, then that's a lot of information that's off the table for consideration by this body as we make policy going forward.
Mm-hmm. It's not fair.
All right. 10 seconds. Go.
Okay. One. So I hear that, but also, if they're suspending, terminating, or ending payments, then they are investigating and are doing something. So, in the same breath, the language in here says they're doing something, so we should make it available. But they're doing something, so we shouldn't wait to see if they're actually convicted and that we actually find that they were wrong. We should just tell everybody before we get to that point. I don't get it. It doesn't – I'm not trying to be difficult. I genuinely do not understand how that makes any sense because, to me – if I say, you know what, Walter, I think you messed this up. I'm going to stop paying you for a minute while we figure it out. And then we get to figure it out and you didn't screw it up. Then I don't know why we would talk about it until we get to the end. It feels like we're in the middle of the novel and we're making a decision about who to tell about the middle of the story before we get to the end. I don't like it because I think we should let the process work itself out.
Okay. So I was very indulgent there. Representative Hudson, do you want to say anything before vote? Representative Hudson.
Very, very quickly, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your indulgence. So, listen, we've played this movie before earlier today when you were presenting a bill and I didn't understand where you were coming from at all. So I get it. Sometimes there's a lack of connection in terms of what's going on inside of each other's heads. But the fact of the matter is, I think what this comes down to is an issue of disparity in trust. I think your side trusts the administration quite a bit, and our side most definitely does not. And that's really, when you start from those different premises, you're going to come up with different ideal policy solutions. So,
with that, I'll renew my motion to re-refer House File 3542 as amended to the Committee on Human Services. There being a roll call, the clerk will take the roll. The chair votes aye, but West votes aye.
Okay, Chair West, aye. Katiza Batun?
No.
Vice Chair Hansen?
No, not until stakeholders are engaged, thanks.
Vice Chair Nelson?
Aye.
Rep Altendorf?
Aye. Oops, aye.
Rep Coulter?
No.
Rep Hicks?
No.
Rep Lee?
No.
Rep McDonald?
Aye.
Rep Nadeau?
Nadeau, aye.
Rep Olson?
Yep.
Rep Perez Vega?
No.
Rep Sensor Mura?
No.
Rep Zalesnikar?
There being seven votes aye, seven nay, the motion does not prevail. And I will lay over House File 3542. Now we move on to the best bill ever. House File, I will move House File 3819 to be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
Okay, Chair West, are you ready?
I'm ready for action.
Okay. The House File 3819 will be re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. You have an author's amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Okay, to the A1 amendment, if you'd like to go ahead and describe it, please.
The A1 amendment incorporate some feedback we got from the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. So it makes some minor changes to accommodate input they had. And I would appreciate if members would amend the bill.
Okay. Go to questions first or move the amendment? All those in favor say aye. Those opposed?
Aye.
Okay, all opposed? The motion prevails. Sorry, I'm out of practice here. And the amendment is adopted. So, Chair West, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, House File 3819 is a bill to address what we've been hearing a lot about in recent days related to the integrity of state government programs. Now, we spent a lot of time in this committee asking questions of the department, talking with experts and stakeholders, and trying to get the bottom of how can we ensure that state programs are used for the intended purpose and not exploited by those who do not truly need any assistance. And one thing we've seen, state programs aren't doing so hot. Even in a report that was 90% redacted, we see an estimate $1 billion worth of fraud. It has been a very, very it's not a good look for Minnesota and our government, which we used to be known for good government. So, with that in mind, we have to do something about this. I mean, the fraud epidemic has gotten so bad that it's no longer just Republicans pointing to the fraud. Now, it seems, based on the actions of the governor, that we do have some bipartisan movement and bipartisan concern about addressing the integrity of state programs. So, what House File 3819 does is, number one, it has the department put out a report annually of disaggregated program data that shows what they have done related to fraud. That is one of the big concerns, one of the ways things get blown up and people really don't have any faith is if they can't, if they feel that their government is not doing anything. And demonstrating what is being done on fraud would go a long way to restoring some faith in our government's ability to have integrity in their programs. The bill also clarifies that inspections must be in person and they must not give advance notice. Now, this is very important because one of the things we heard while talking to the Inspector General and others from the department is that there is a difference between a licensing visit and a program integrity visit. Now, there's a licensing visit every year, but the fraud reporting element of it is optional. And one concern is, well, how bad does it have to be for a licensing visit to actually fill out that optional paperwork? What we have seen does not inspire confidence. And that's one of the reasons why this has been a national news story. So requiring inspectors to consult our new and improved electronic attendance tracking on their visits will help ensure that at the very least, they're checking the attendance, seeing it if it jives from what's there. Because what we have heard is that it's optional and it likely needs to be pretty bad for an inspector to actually want to do something. Whereas I think Minnesotans expect government to be judicious about detecting fraud in their programs. The bill also establishes a deadline, another issue that came up. And believe it or not, when we ask the department questions in this committee, it does affect how we write our bills. We heard the rollout plan for electronic attendance, which is one of the few things that was done to address fraud in recent sessions. And it was said that, okay, we're going to roll it out partially, and then we're going to roll it out to almost everyone probably down the road. But we didn't get any specifics from the department. So this is expected to start in June. This bill, with the enactment date of January 2027, says, okay, you're going to roll it out January 1, 2027. You have 6 months to figure it out. And given how long it's taken and how much money we've appropriated, I feel confident that the department can meet that. This also requires centers that receive more than $500,000 of CCAP and or early learning scholarship money to have one additional licensing visit, well, to ensure they are meeting the standards that we have laid out. And it requires them to have cameras covering their entrances and exits. Now, there have been only a few convicted fraud cases in Minnesota in the last several years related to CCAP program, and I believe one of them talked about children would go in the front door and then out the back. And if the centers, which if we at this limit, we would be capturing an enormous amount of the total CCAP dollars spent, if these centers that have over $500,000 of taxpayer money were required to have cameras, the department would be able to access those cameras, but request the footage from the provider and be able to verify whether or not they are reporting their attendance accurately. It's a cost-effective way of ensuring the integrity of the system because we want the people who actually need the assistance to get the assistance. And I mean, $1 of fraud is too many, but certainly what we've seen in other programs is the number is enormous. It also, so the original bill had a 28-day data retention, but in conversations with the department, they said we need more than that if we are going to use this in our investigations. So the amendment put that up to 90 days because they have to show a pattern if they are going to pursue an investigation to some sort of action. They need that evidence. And it also, if they cannot provide the footage that they are retaining, that can be used as evidence that they did not care for children in that time, so that there can be no funny business in these situations. And lastly, it restores the penalty of perjury when submitting false attendance records, or records in general. Now, this used to be how things were done prior to 2013. So this is merely reinstating what has been done in the past, and it addresses one of the biggest concerns is it's very difficult. We have vulnerabilities. The Office of the Legislative Auditor and others pointed out vulnerabilities, but trying to bring it into an area where we can actually have a conviction or some sort of rooting out of fraud is incredibly difficult, and they don't really have the tools to do so. So these things as a whole are a relatively balanced approach. It's nothing radical. Most of this has been heard before, but it's a very cost-effective, efficient way to take seriously the concerns of fraud, because we want these systems to go to those who need it. We know tough economic times are ahead, and this is a way that we can efficiently target the highest dollar amounts for extra integrity measures so that people can receive the assistance who actually need it, and Minnesotans as a whole can have confidence in their public assistance systems. So with that, I will stand for questions.
Okay, I think before we go to testimony, Chair Katiza-Watoon has a question.
Thank you. Chair Nelson, and Chair West, you just said that this was very similar to how things were done prior to 2013, and I missed what part of the bill you were talking about, and I'm hoping that you can just clarify, because, of course, that was before either of us were in the legislature, and just want to make sure that I'm understanding properly.
Chair West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Katiza-Watoon, for the question, referring only to the perjury section. On just that.
Okay. All right, Chair Katiza-Watoon.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. That was just a quick point of clarification. We're going to allow the chair to move on with his bill presentation and testifiers.
Okay. I think we'll get at questions in a little bit. Right now, we are running on kind of a limited time, so we do have some public testimony. I know that these folks have traveled to get here, taken off time, so we are going to get to that, and if you could, please keep your comments brief. We are running low on time, and I know that you did take time out of your day to come here. So with that, we will go to Courtney Greiner. And then after that, Maria Schneider, if you could kind of maybe make your way up to the testifying table. So. Ms. Greiner, if you would please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed to the testimony.
Absolutely. My name is Courtney Greiner. I own a licensed childcare center serving 90 children and 30 employees, which allows hundreds of people in our community to go to work every day. I work with all of these amazing providers in the crowd and many more that can't be here today. I was also here last year during the same, not the same bill, but similar bill, and continue to show up, desperately trying to help you understand that the impossible margins and unfunded mandates are killing us. This isn't a dog and pony show to me. This is my life. This is my work. This is my career, and this is my dream. And instead of doing that work, here I am again, defending myself and other providers in this room against unwarranted attacks and expensive mandates. I also went to D.C. last week. We were invited to visit Stauber's office, and instead of inviting us in the door, we were met in the hallway because he was hosting Nick Shirley and David Hawk instead. Those are the same people whose viral videos caused harm that you heard earlier, defecating on doorsteps, death threats, and harassment. Many of you in this room celebrated those videos, shared on social media, and continue this harm that the two men caused through narrative. These were multiple grown men harassing child care centers and the children and teachers inside of them. According to some of you that earlier, those are the ones that should be in jail, that we should have stronger legislation for. If you believe this bill will prevent fraud, you're mistaken. Instead, it targets providers of color, providers who care for low-income families, and the kids that they provide care for. Monique said it before, our brown and black children have already been through enough. These are our children, our neighbors, and these are my colleagues and friends that this is harming. The environment this bill is being born into. The bill was here last year. It's back this year alongside federal fraud narrative and federal funding freeze due to alleged fraud.
If you could please wrap up your testimony.
I do have cameras at my center. They were paid for grant money. They're expensive and not cost efficient or affordable. And like other technology, they aren't perfect. Power goes out, cameras fail. This is a reality. These are expensive systems.
Ms. Greiner, if you could please wrap up your testimony.
I just want to name the last 6 months have been unbearable. And if you want to protect children, invest in us, the people who have dedicated our lives to caring for them. Give us the resources they need to ensure every child is safe and cared for. This isn't it. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Schneider.
Snyder. When the federal government threatened to cut off child care assistance for 23,000 children in December, I feared that it was part of a larger strategy to discredit child care providers and ultimately cut funding for child care assistance, which truly helps thousands of Minnesota families. I saw this happen in 2018, almost like the same narrative on repeat, and I see it coming to reality now with this bill. A fear-based narrative around fraud is being used to override children's rights, compromise their confidentiality, and create new pathways to criminalize childcare providers like me. I want to put some of the numbers in context. $500,000 of childcare assistance that's a lot of money, right? It's about 20 preschoolers, so that's one classroom. I heard a comment from Representative West that it's pretty cost effective. It might be cost effective for the state, but it wouldn't be very cost effective for me, a small business owner. I would have to pay out of pocket for those cameras, and it's pretty expensive. The last estimate I got was about $12,000 for cameras. This requires video monitoring without providing funding or support. Camera systems, we're not IT departments, we're educators. The bill also states that if footage cannot be produced for a period of time, it will be treated as evidence that zero children were cared for. Technology fails, systems glitch, humans make mistakes, and to treat that as proof of fraud is unreasonable and overly punitive. We don't impose this level of government surveillance on dentists or nursing homes or other licensed service providers, regardless of what people are saying on YouTube. The truth is that childcare is one of the most heavily regulated industries in our state, and this bill will ultimately reduce the number of providers that are willing to accept childcare assistance, which is a number that's already shrinking due to many of the factors you've heard about today. It will deter families from accessing childcare assistance because they don't want their six-week-olds surveilled by the government, and deter families in general from enrolling in programs that accept CCAP because even their kids would also be on these government surveillance cameras.
Ms. Snyder, if you could please wrap up your testimony.
If we care about preventing fraud, I really hope that we will invest in training, collaboration, family affordability, and living wages for teachers, not surveillance and punishment. Thank you for your time.
Monique, please.
Again, my name is Monique Stuman. I'm here today because, no disrespect, but the people that are writing these bills are not the ones up at 6 a.m. opening doors, feeding our children, comforting toddlers, and holding this system together. We are the ones holding this system together, and we want to be at the table. I just recently got awarded guardianship of the child that I've been caring for the last 9 months. He was in my infant program. He was in my toddler program. And his grandmother saw fit when she passed away for me to care for him. We are not criminals. The great majority, I can't stop saying that. And I feel like that's how you guys treat us. And it is unfair. Again, Senator West, I was at that round table and I felt your pain. And I felt your rage to the point where I was shaken to my core with your response. And you came to me and apologized afterwards. And I took that to heart. And I took that you were going to listen. And I took that you were going to understand what we needed as well. I have cameras as well, and I have had to turn them off and turn them back on a number of times in the last 3 years because I can't afford them. I got a child, foster child, that I'm caring for, not getting enough money for. But I'm doing it because this is what I choose to do. But for you all to belittle what we're doing or undervalue us or disrespect us, because that's what it feels like, Senator McDonald. That's what it feels like. That's what it feels like, Senator Olson. That's what it feels like.
Monique,
it feels like y'all are dishonoring us, disvaluing us.
If you could please wrap up your testimony.
So I'm saying, don't put any more pressure on us. The people that are committing these frauds, hold them accountable. But don't make all of us pay for it. Don't make all of us suffer. Because a great majority of us, we kept your kids during COVID. We stayed open. That appreciation that you gave us then, give it to us now. Give it to us now. I beg of you, don't put any more burdens on us. The people that are doing this, then yes, put that on them. But not us that are doing this out of what we love to do. And so again, I keep asking you all, stop making us feel like we are criminals because we are not.
Next, we have Claire Sanford on the list. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I'm still Claire Sanford and still with the Minnesota Child Care Association. I would like to talk about one overarching concern in this bill. It seems that we keep, and we've talked about this, the committee has talked about this today, mixing financial fraud and program integrity with licensing and safety issues, and they are, two different things. Financial fraud is a crime, obviously, and a disgusting one, and it is different from regulatory citations. A provider can have a perfect licensing record and still be intentionally bilking the state. A provider can have a horrendous licensing record and have perfect and ethical accounting. They are not the same thing. I'd like to speak to the program integrity portions of this bill. MCCA has no issue with truly unannounced licensing visits. Let's do it. Electronic attendance records, we've supported that. It's to be implemented later this year. We have no issue with additional scrutiny for programs receiving public funding and look forward to continuing to work through issues in this bill to get it to a place that could work for providers. But there are some examples in here of the things we'd like to continue to have conversation about, such as, is the best answer to additional scrutiny for a certain threshold of public money at a provider, if that's a program integrity issue, is the best response another licensing visit, or would it be another auditing visit from the Office of Inspector General? Because they're the ones who are actually looking at the fraud issue and double-checking things, whereas the licensors are there looking at your diaper-changing procedure and so on and so forth. The video monitoring issues that have been brought up, it does not seem unreasonable to set a threshold of public funding and have additional scrutiny for that. But, you know, the tech issues, the no hold harmless for other licensing violations that might show up in that video, like is in HS.
Ms. Sanford, if we could wrap up the
testimony,
please.
Sure.
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. It's okay. And the dollar threshold to prompt additional scrutiny, it would be good to know a fiscal note and the number of programs affected. I believe the 1 million threshold was about 100 centers statewide, so I don't know what it would cost to have the additional staff of the state to carry out more visits if the threshold was 500K. And also, as another testifier pointed out, it sounds like an astronomical amount of public money, but that can be 500K can be 11% of the kids served at 150 child care center. And the last thing I'll say is also to a previous point, We have to find the sweet spot on financial threshold and regulatory burden because we don't want more families using public supports turned away from child care providers who are trying to reduce their costs and regulatory burden. Thank you.
And I think we have one testifier via Zoom.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, if you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Amanda Ashton, and as a parent of young children, my family relies on childcare every single day. I've seen firsthand the love, care, and dedication that our early educators pour into my kids. I'm here in strong opposition to this bill. First, this bill unfairly targets children whose families rely on CCAP, families who are disproportionately low income, and families of color. Singling out centers serving these children for heightened surveillance sends a troubling message that these families deserve less trust and more scrutiny. That is plainly discrimination. Second, CCAP providers already operate under extensive compliance requirements. Mandating cameras come with installation costs, data storage requirements, maintenance, and important privacy management, which creates yet another unfunded burden for providers already stretched to the limit. Perhaps most critically, using cameras as anti-fraud is fundamentally inappropriate when we are talking about young children. Requiring centers to record and store video footage of children introduces serious privacy and security risks. The risk that footage of young children could be accessed or weaponized is not hypothetical. It's real, and it is unacceptable. All children deserve safe, nurturing environments built on trust, not invasive state surveillance imposed on families simply because they need assistance. Installing cameras as a symbolic solution to a minimal problem does not strengthen childcare. It undermines it. This is not an appropriate recommendation. I urge you all to reject this bill and instead focus on policies that truly strengthen childcare and protect children. By this, I mean sustainable funding that makes childcare more affordable for families, higher livable wages for our highly trained early educators, which creates professionalism and stability for our teachers. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you for testimony. Is there any other public testimony? Okay, hearing none. I think it was at Rep. Hansen, Representative Hansen, or co-vice chair Hansen has a question.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. It's good to be today. I offer the DE. I'd like to move the DE1 amendment, please.
We have the DE1 before us. Representative Hansen moves the DE1. And let's see. Yeah, go ahead and speak to your amendment.
Thank you, Chair. This is an amendment we've seen before. I'll be quick given the time. I'm hoping that we can lay this on the table and continue this conversation hopefully another day and not try to rush through it. I do think this is a really important conversation that we need to be having. As I've talked about before, I'm not opposed to cameras in daycares. That's not my position. But I do think it's important that we talk about how we don't cut corners in public policy that involves the safety of our children, particularly in the era where they are facing the assaults of child sexual abusers more than ever before on the internet. And so their images are susceptible to this. We know the images of children and toddlers are among the most sought after images by pedophiles and predators who seek to create AI child porn, and that is driving up a lot of other issues that I could go on and on and on about. So for the sake of time, my DE1 puts the cart behind the horse and the horse in front of the cart, as it should be. So before we continue to move too fast, we get some guardrails in place for what surveilling children in child care looks like. So this is a task force that would be tasked with giving us a recommendation here at the legislature, comprised of cybersecurity experts, members from both bodies of the legislature, parents who've had their children harmed or worse, tragically, in a child care facility, child care workers from a variety of settings, folks from the department, attorneys who have worked on these cases, and law enforcement who's worked on these cases, and I'm open to any suggestions for others. And then making sure that they're giving us some recommendations about how we can design some best practices around this, including encryption for stored video footage, how we can notify parents of any data breaches, things like that. I think it's fair to assume, I think we heard earlier one of the providers say, I'm not an IT center, I'm a child care provider, and I don't think it's fair to expect these small business owners to take on that task as well, given the child care crisis we're in, nor to absorb the costs that these would have. So I think before we charge forward with a mandate like this without any identified funds to help support it, we should really take a moment and take a breath and look at what we can do to get this right. Our children's safety is on the line. If you're not familiar with how prevalent child sexual abuse material is right now, you will be disgusted if you Google it. The first 10, 15 pages of Google results will be very recent articles talking about every single law enforcement agency around the globe, every NGO around the globe, every policymaker around the globe having some, messages to policymakers around the globe asking us to get ahead of this. This is a chance that we have to be the North Star state that we are and to shine and to get ahead of something that is not quite here yet because they are still struggling to get access to these CCTV footage, but it's not impossible. So sorry for going long, but that's what my amendment is. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair West, to the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Co-Vice Chair Hansen. If anybody's talked to me for a little bit, they've heard how much I loathe task forces in general. That is because sometimes they work, but generally, if people don't like the results, change is nothing. In addition, if some creeper wants to have access and film children, there are a number of ways they can do so. This particular bill has cameras at the entrances and exits, which many centers already do have that. And a perp could probably sit in a parking lot and film them from afar, which is gross and disgusting, but it's certainly something that can happen, and that would be better footage on their creepy high-def camera than a security camera. So I would urge members not to support this DE amendment.
Okay. Thank you, and
Chair Nelson, can I respond to that?
Thank
you, Chair. Just really quick, I understand that task forces aren't always the best way, but we are not experts. None of us are cybersecurity experts. None of us can foresee what's happening. I think I may be one of the only ones on this committee as familiar with the prevalence of child sexual abuse material, and I would love to sit down and tell you everything I know about this because it is so ugly and so awful, and this used to be a bipartisan issue of protecting children from pedophiles and predators like this, and I think it still is. I really do. I do think there is support on both sides of the aisle to get this right, and I don't think that this assigning it to a task force is brushing it off or pushing it down the road. I actually think this is getting ahead of it. And we would all have something to bring back to our districts to say, this is what I did to fight against one of the most dangerous things children face. There will be 3 million babies born this year. 1 million of them will be molested before they turn 18. We have to face this, and we have to talk about how dangerous this is. And this is the committee where these conversations have to happen. This is the Children and Families Committee. This is a danger our children are facing. Please join me in getting this right. We cannot cut corners on this, folks. Please. Thank you.
With that, all in favor of the DE1, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
No. I think it's probably tied, so it fails. And two, the bill as amended, and referring it to the Judiciary Committee.
Chair Nelson, I would like to move that we lay this over so that we can continue to have a more broad conversation. Given the time, I think a lot of my members are wanting to ask more questions, but we're clearly out of time. So unless you guys have magically found more time.
I don't know. We did get permission to go over. We did get permission to go over. I know that we are getting quite long, but I don't know.
Chair Nelson, if that's the request, then I would just ask that before we go to a vote, that members would be given a chance to speak. I think the assumption was because of the time that we were probably going to lay it over and bring it back up. So just before we go to a vote, I would just like to give my members the courtesy of having a chance to talk to.
With Chair West, any...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. members will, while we've discussed many of these issues already, we are happy to have discussions as we move through the process, but these bills do need to move in order for them to advance. So I would move that we refer the bill to the Judiciary Committee as amended.
Quickly, Representative Coulter.
Well, first of all, I'd like to request a roll call. I have to say I understand that we went a little bit longer on the first bill than I think any of us expected, but I object to be being pushed along on this bill. This is a big bill. This does serious things, and we need more time to discuss this. So I'm gonna say what I'm gonna say. I'm gonna ask my questions, and I hope I can get to my kids' conference at 6 o'clock. So I want to just sort of start off generally. My understanding is the premise of this bill is that it is an effective way to deter and investigate fraud is to mandate video cameras on private property. Am I getting that correctly?
Chair West.
Well, yeah.
Okay.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative West, for making it clear that on the record that we believe that that is an effective way to get at fraud. The reason that I ask this is that on February 9th of this year, less than a month ago, one person who lives in Prior Lake was charged with $350 million of tax fraud, a bigger number that you might remember than the Feeding Our Future issue. $350 million. He also, according to the indictment, advised a group of, quote, sovereign citizens on how they could do the same thing. So you used a term, I was going to ask you this question, but I won't, but you used the term programs a lot. And I think what that betrays, or what that the message that sends, whatever I think your intent may be, is that fraud is not as important if it comes from other sources, if it comes from tax fraud, if it comes from dollars that certain kinds of people use in certain kind of ways. But the questions that I want to ask, so Representative Hansen, I think, alluded to this. We obviously had a big discussion about this last year, about cameras and surveillance of kids. And my understanding was that
We are out of time. Chair West, if you could give your closing remarks.
Excuse me?
Yeah, we have to be done at 5 o'clock. That's what we're...
Mr. Chair.
Chair West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I'm not one to jam people. So I think I would move to lay this bill over because I am about the policy, and I hope that members can restrain their outrage and channel that into productive activities and avoid besmirching other members' integrity and focus on the task in front of us. And to that end is how seriously I take policy work, because it drives me nuts to do stupid politics. And that is why I would rather lay the bill over than do any shenanigans. So, Mr. Chair, I don't even know if I can do that because I'm not chairing the committee, actually. But, Chair. So,
with that, House File 3819 is laid over. And members, we are adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you.